Hello and welcome to the September 2nd, 2025 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here to provide a quick summary of what's new on annals.org. Let's get started without delay. If you go to annals.org, you'll find a systematic review that examines currently available evidence on associations of high-concentration delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol cannabis products with mental health outcomes. The authors identified and analyzed 99 studies, including over 220,000 participants reported between 1977 and 2023. Study selection was intentionally broad and included studies examining associations between high-concentration cannabis products and mental health outcomes, regardless of whether the study's primary purpose was to evaluate therapeutic effects or not. High-concentration cannabis products were defined as having THC concentration exceeding 5 milligrams of THC or 10% THC per serving, or products described as high-potency concentrate, shatter, or dab. The mental health outcomes of interest included anxiety, depression, psychosis, schizophrenia, cannabis use disorder, and other substance use disorders. The researchers defined acute effects as those that occurred within 12 hours of exposure, post-acute effects as those occurring after consistent use for 1 to 2 months, and long-term effects as those occurring after consistent use for 1 year. In studies not testing for therapeutic effects, high-concentration cannabis products were associated with psychosis, schizophrenia, and cannabis use disorder. No studies of the therapeutic effects found favorable effects on psychosis or schizophrenia. Of non-therapeutic studies, 53% identified unfavorable associations with anxiety, and 41% found unfavorable associations with depression. Among therapeutic studies exploring therapeutic effects on anxiety and depression, some suggested beneficial effects for anxiety and depression, while others suggested unfavorable effects. The findings reinforce previous conclusions that higher THC concentrations increase the risk for adverse mental health outcomes. However, the available evidence falls short of providing the definitive evidence needed to provide clear advice to patients. Next is the report of a secondary analysis of the PREDIMED Plus randomized trial that evaluated whether an energy-reduced Mediterranean diet plus physical activity reduced diabetes incidence compared to a standard Mediterranean diet in adults with overweight or obesity and metabolic syndrome. The primary analysis examined cardiovascular outcomes, but diabetes incidence was a pre-specified secondary outcome, and that is the outcome focused on in this report. Participants in this analysis included 4,746 adults aged 55 to 75 years with overweight or obesity, with metabolic syndrome, but no documented cardiovascular disease or diabetes at baseline. Participants randomized to the intervention group were instructed to follow a calorie-restricted Mediterranean diet with physical activity recommendations and behavioral support for weight loss. The control group received educational sessions on the traditional Mediterranean diet with ad libitum caloric intake. Diabetes incidence was assessed yearly for 7 years of follow-up, with the American Diabetes Association criteria being used to ascertain incident diabetes. After 6 years, the adjusted relative risk reduction of the intervention compared to control group was 31% with confidence intervals that spanned 18% to 41%. This reduction was consistent across subgroups of age, education, and baseline metabolic status, with greater effect observed in men than in women. The researchers conclude that this multi-component lifestyle modification represents a practical and sustainable strategy that could be incorporated into routine clinical practice for diabetes prevention. It's common for patients with rheumatoid arthritis on disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs to undergo long-term testing for drug toxicity, but the cumulative probabilities of abnormal or very abnormal tests has not been described. Researchers in the Netherlands studied data from 4,774 patients with rheumatoid arthritis undergoing long-term monitoring after at least 6 months of disease-modifying therapy between July 2008 and April 2020. Routine laboratory toxicity monitoring was conducted in all patients at weeks 4, 8, 12, and 24 after the start of the disease-modifying drug, followed by long-term monitoring every 3 to 6 months. Study patients were on a wide range of traditional and biologic therapies. The test set included 5 laboratory parameters: alanine aminotransferase, estimated glomerular filtration rate, hemoglobin, leukocyte count, and platelet count. Results were categorized as abnormal and very abnormal, with cutoffs based on guidelines, clinical treatment recommendations, or expert opinion as available. The primary outcome was a cumulative incidence of new abnormal or very abnormal long-term monitoring results at 2 and 5 years after initiation of individual or combination disease-modifying therapy. The researchers found that among 297,775 long-term monitoring tests during the study period, 5.8% of the results were abnormal and 0.69% of the results were very abnormal. The data also showed that in addition to being uncommon, most abnormal results were already clinically anticipated and often occurred after dose escalation. The authors conclude that the practice of performing routine, frequent, long-term monitoring in all patients with rheumatoid arthritis using disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs should be reconsidered, as the findings call into question the value of non-targeted monitoring. Many patients eligible for colorectal cancer screening don't receive screening. It's hypothesized that screening rates could be improved by providing personalized risk information to patients and their clinicians. The next study I'll highlight sought to test this hypothesis. The researchers randomized 214 clinicians and 1,084 average-risk patients due for colorectal cancer screening to view a colorectal cancer screening decision aid with or without a personalized message about their risk. The outcome measured was completion of screening within 6 months. Overall, there were no differences in screening uptake between the groups. Although when the researchers dug into exploratory sub-analyses, they did find a suggestion of improved uptake of stool testing in one of the study health systems. Next is a History of Medicine article that examines the ethical challenges that medical experts have navigated when mobilizing biological and psychological evidence to advocate for transgender patients in legal proceedings across the past quarter century. Given the current debate over transgender care, such advocacy is likely to be increasingly important. There is an ongoing debate about the value of the peer review process. A brief research report aims to look into this issue. The researchers assessed abstracts of all randomized controlled trials submitted to the New England Journal of Medicine in 2022. If the manuscript was rejected from New England Journal, they searched PubMed using author names for articles published elsewhere within 2 years of submission. 4 physicians matched published with submitted manuscripts and systematically assessed substantive changes between submitted and published abstracts using a tool that assessed improvements in clarity, completeness, and adherence to scientific standards across 4 key domains: trial design, primary outcome, adverse events, and whether the conclusions were appropriately supported by the results without bias or misrepresentation. They identified 496 trials, 156 were eventually published in New England Journal, and 340 were rejected and published in 128 other journals. They rated 59% of abstracts as improved, with the conclusion being the most frequently improved domain. They found that improvement was most likely in abstracts published in general medical journals with high impact factors. Additionally, more than half of abstracts published in non-open access journals had substantive improvements, whereas most, over 50% published in open access journals, showed no substantive changes. The authors note the growing popularity of preprint servers allowing accelerated dissemination of scientific findings, bypassing formal editorial review, and concerns about the reliability of unvetted research. They conclude that their results highlight that substantial revisions and improvements occur between submission and publication, supporting the value of editorial oversight in helping to communicate research with accuracy and integrity. And staying on the topic of scholarly publishing, next is a provocative ideas and opinions commentary in which the authors express frustration over the speed of the current peer review process at scholarly medical journals. They call for a new generation of academic leaders who value efficiency to create a system where researchers are expected and professional advancement is based on work posted on open servers, where peer review occurs subsequent to, rather than before, this posting. They argue that such a system would enable academics to leverage the limited availability of research dollars and time to complete work, disseminate it broadly, and demonstrate impact. They recognize that such changes would require institutions and funding bodies to move away from promotion and funding decisions that are tightly linked to peer review publication counts, instead valuing a diverse array of research contributions. Important to note that some of the authors are closely affiliated with the type of platforms that they advocate. In an accompanying editorial, the editor of a prominent German medical journal notes that impatience with bureaucracy is currently in large supply across the globe. Yet he writes that, tempting as it may be to envision a new order, we should be careful what we wish for before we abandon the existing system of scholarly publishing. I encourage listeners interested in the way medical research is assessed and disseminated to read these provocative articles and use the comments feature to share your own views about peer review with the authors, editors, and other readers. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.